You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the State Department of Justice is filing a lawsuit aimed at blocking Wisconsin's 1849 law that bans almost all abortions. We'll talk with Attorney General Josh Call about the legal challenge. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade was not the only big ruling to come out over the last week. The justices also released decisions in a pair of cases that set precedent on religion and public schools. First, they struck down a Maine law that prevented taxpayer dollars from funding tuition for religious schools as part of a program that helped people in rural areas without local schools pay the cost of private schools. Then the court ruled that a high school football coach could be allowed to pray on the field after games. In those cases, players and others gathered around him during the prayers. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you view the separation between church and state and how it plays out, especially in issues affecting public schools? Do you support the idea of using public dollars in some cases to pay religious school tuition? Do you think school authorities, school employees should be allowed to pray on school grounds? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is professor of political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I gave very capsule headline summaries of both those cases. Let's pick them apart a little more. Let's start with this newest ruling on a high school football coach. The court ruled that a school couldn't prevent him from doing these prayers on the 50-yard line after games. We see images of people gathered around him. Can you talk more about that case and what the Supreme Court decided?
Sure. It's really a strikingly radical change in the rules about religion in schools, but to understand why, one has to dig into it fairly closely. So for a long time, there have been two principles that governed how the Establishment Clause works in the school context. One is that children are vulnerable. So things that we might allow adults to do, the classic example is prayers at legislative sessions or prayers when a court opens up the session, those might be okay because we expect that adults who don't share the religious belief of the prayer won't feel somehow pressed or coerced to act as though they do or feel that they ought to. But historically, for at least 50 years, we've said that children has been always defined to include anyone up to the end of high school, are vulnerable. If they see their teachers or their school administrators leading prayers or engaging in religious activities or promoting religion, we worry that the students will experience this as a kind of coercion to try and make them want to join that religion. One thing that's really striking about this opinion in Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, which is the case that you're talking about, is that that distinction is completely absent. In writing the opinion, Alito relied on cases involving adults, and particularly a case called Town of Greece versus Galloway, involving prayers at legislative sessions. And in that case, there's all kinds of discussion about how adults are different from children. That distinction simply disappeared and isn't mentioned at all. The second really striking thing here is that, as you mentioned, anyone who's followed this case at all in the news has seen these photographs of dozens of players in uniform, kneeling on the 50-yard line with a crowd around them. That's not how the court described events. The court described events as the coach taking a knee all by himself, away from the students, praying in silence. In other words, it was a blatantly, I don't know how else to say this, dishonest description of the facts and circumstances designed to create a scenario that would enable them to say that the school was suppressing this coach's exercise of his free speech and religious free exercise rights. And the third thing that's very, very striking about this case is the thing I just mentioned, the way it combines free exercise and free speech to argue that school teachers, coaches, and presumably other public officials, but specifically school teachers and school employees, have a combined right of free expression and free exercise, and that when those two rights combine, they become exceptionally strong, and that's what protects this public act of prayer by a school official during the school hours, while on duty, while around students. So all three of those points that I just mentioned are just complete departures from easily 50 years of jurisprudence in this area and signal a very, very radical turn toward allowing, if not requiring, a much greater presence for religious expression and religious, I don't want to say indoctrination, but let's say encouraging religiosity in public school settings.
An argument is a kid isn't required to go up and kneel around the coach. Say in this instance, they could stay on the sidelines, talk to their friends, whatever. What do you make of that? That's a response I've seen anyway. It's not coercion. It's voluntary.
Sure. So again, this is not a new issue. The most famous case of this had to do with prayers at a high school graduation. And again, for not quite 50 years, in this case, it's merely 40 years, or 30 years. For 30 years, there's been a well-established proposition that say that where young people are concerned, especially school children, we're likely to find coercion in situations where we might not find it in the case of adults. And so we recognize the social pressure might be placed on students to participate in religious activity. In this case, there was more. The school district reported hearing complaints that students felt that if they didn't participate in the prayers, they wouldn't get playing time. And journalists who spoke to students heard from them directly that they felt that the coach wouldn't favor them on the field if they didn't participate in these prayer exercises, and that at least some of them said they did so unwillingly in order to remain in good graces with the coach. Confronted by this argument, the court's attitude was, well, that's only hearsay. We don't have real evidence of that, and so we're not going to consider the question. As I say, the justices in the majority really dramatically rewrote the facts to create a set of situations that would enable them to say that none of the traditional tests that have governed religion in schools should apply here, and then turned around and made a rule that arguably undercuts all those earlier rules altogether. So the question is, in a future case, if there really is evidence of coercion, let's leave aside the question of what happened here. Suppose in a future case, a coach says to prayers, you can't play unless you join my prayers. You know, what will a court do then? The way the Supreme Court handled the facts in this case, you might think it's easy to say, aha, this is different. This one has coercion and that one didn't, right? That is, accepting the facts on their face as presented by the majority. The problem is that the new explanation of the rules involved governing the conduct of teachers is such that it's very unclear how the Establishment Clause would limit those activities at all. The other question is that coercion is not the only standard under the Establishment Clause. Until, well, yesterday, there's also been a rule that public endorsement of religion, that is, public declarations that citizens or students in particular in schools who are members of a certain religion are more fully appreciated as citizens than those who are not, or that religious affiliation has something to do with citizenship or with the status of a student or with being a student in a school. That was separate from coercion. That was viewed as a violation of the Establishment Clause. That's simply off the table. That entire theory of endorsement has been abolished by this one decision. And even beyond that, you'll notice I'm emphasizing the radicalness of this decision that I intend to. A case that goes back to the 1970s called Lemon versus Kurtzman, which was just a general overall framework for considering Establishment Clause questions, has also been overruled. And what's most striking is that in the opinion, the court simply says, well, we're not overruling it. We're simply assuming this case had effectively been overruled before, and we expected everyone to know that. It's a very strange opinion that way. It's very unusual, not to say unheard of, for the court to say a major precedent was overruled even though we never said so. And you, the lower courts, and you, the public, are simply expected to have understood that at some point in the last 30 years. And we're now declaring going forward, not that we need to overrule that case, it simply isn't a precedent anymore. It is not a precedent anymore, and let's go forward from here. It's a wildly sweeping decision that goes much further than it needed to resolve this case, and does so in a way that formally announces that the Establishment Clause is dramatically weakened and has dramatically less force than it did last week.
Talking to Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison about two U.S. Supreme Court decisions on religion and public schools. Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Josh is with us in Mineral Point. Josh, hi.
Yes, I mean, I understand the difference between church and state and everything else, but What would we got a bunch of white Christians in the Supreme Court now. What's the difference if someone by the name of Ali put a prayer blanket down at the end of the field and started praying? Would the Supreme Court have overturned it then?
Josh, thanks for the call. Howard, I know this is a question I've seen other people bring up. Would non-Christians trying to do something similar enjoy similar protections?
My assumption is yes. Now, the caveat there is the point I made earlier about, I think I misspoke, Gorsuch wrote the opinion, how he manipulated the facts. So there's always the possibility that if we have a future case with, let us say, a Muslim football coach who, as the caller says, puts down his prayer rug and prays at the 50-yard line. You know, a court will find a way to distinguish that case on the facts somehow. But more generally, this court is perfectly happy, and these, as the caller says, white Christian justices are perfectly happy to allow religious expression in general, because they understand that in this country, the vast majority of the time, that's going to be Christian expression. In other words, it's a version of neutrality that says we will accept all religions equally, and we will pay no attention to the fact that some religions are much more majoritarian than others in our particular society, and that it is much, much more likely that a non-Christian student will be made to feel isolated by public displays of Christian worship than the opposite.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to UW-Madison political science professor Howard Schwaber about church and state and public schools in the wake of two new U.S. Supreme Court rulings, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think state tax money should be used to support religious schools in some instances? When yes, when no? Do you think school officials should be allowed to publicly hold prayers on school grounds, to lead prayer circles, for example? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments or your questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison political science professor Howard Schwaber. With us today, looking at the legal impact of two recent U.S. Supreme Court rulings over funding religious schools and prayer at a public high school. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. Howard, before we go back to our callers, let's visit Maine now, this other case that led to a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on funding by the state for religious schools. What happened there?
So this is a case that follows up on a series of previous cases over the last few years, dealing with the question of when a state or whether a state may provide funding for some private school activities and not others. Specifically, Maine had a law that said that in rural areas where there was a lack of access to public schools, state funds could be used for parents to send children to private schools. The law had a restriction that said those funds could not be used to send children to religious private schools. Chief Justice Roberts, writing for the majority, said that this is a discrimination against religion. Maine argued that it was not, and that the difference was that the secular private schools offered the same education as the public schools, whereas religious private schools were offering something different, and that was a fair basis for distinction. But Roberts rejected that argument. He said to distinguish between religious private schools and secular private schools is simply discrimination against religion and is impermissible. Therefore, if Maine, and by extension any other state, wants to provide funding for use in any private schools, it must allow those funds to be used in religious private schools. And if I can go back to a point the caller made on the previous case, that will apply equally to Christian schools and Muslim schools and Jewish schools and any other school that is recognized as a religious private school.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Conrad is with us in Platteville. Conrad, hi.
Yeah, I think schools pass state education standards that people's money that they supposedly contribute to the state for education of their own children or their grandchildren or whoever's children should be able to go to any school in that state that meets those standards.
Conrad, thanks a lot for that call. So Howard, I believe Maine had tried to set a standard that that those schools couldn't include a religious indoctrination. I don't know if that's the word they used, but religious instruction. So this ruling would seem to say, no, a state can't set that standard.
That's correct. So, I mean, your caller's point is certainly well taken. As long as the school is providing an education, who cares who is providing the education? The answer is, at least in the past, we used to care about what else the school might be doing. So you can go all the way back to the writings of James Madison, when he wrote his famous essay in Virginia. And he said, it is a crime against conscience to ask someone to contribute tax dollars to be used to promulgate and promote a faith that he doesn't believe in. The problem is not that the religious schools in question are not providing education. The argument was they're also doing something else, which is proselytizing a religion, and public funds shouldn't be used for that purpose, because one person's money shouldn't be used, in this Madisonian notion, to promote a faith in which they do not believe. The Roberts Court has now rejected that principle. and said that the fact that these schools may be engaged in promoting faith and proselytizing or anything else doesn't matter. Those are separate from the fact that they function as schools. In a way, the Roberts Court is taking the same view as our caller. It says as long as they're providing an education, the state has no good basis for excluding them based on what else they might be doing.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking at two U.S. Supreme Court cases on religion and public schools with Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison. Still time for your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You mentioned that the first case we talked about prayer on the football field there, very wide in scope, that ruling with this main school funding one. Do you see this as having a wide scope that's going to affect a lot of other, for example, state school funding laws?
Oh, absolutely. And the two cases go together. So the football coach prayer case weakens the Establishment Clause in the sense it drastically reduces the restrictions that the Establishment Clause places on what is acceptable behavior by public teachers and other public officials. The main case is called Carson versus Macon, weakens a different Establishment Clause principle, which is one that would have until now prohibited using public money for the direct teaching of religion to children, or at least permitted states to refuse to use money to be used that way. What the two cases have in common is they both dramatically weaken the Establishment Clause. And when I say that, I mean in comparison to what it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago. The Establishment Clause, like all constitutional provisions, undergoes evolution over time, and the doctrines have shifted over time. But for at least 50 years, we have said that the use of public money to promulgate religion directly, and particularly to do so in schools, is a line that should not be crossed and is prohibited by the Establishment Clause. This is the latest in a series of cases. There were others in the last couple of 3 years that have removed that restriction and caused the Establishment Clause to become that much weaker. At the same time, the treatment of the football coach emphasizes how much the free exercise clause has been strengthened and has been connected to the free speech clause. So the whole balance, right? Separation of church and state is a slogan. In practice, it's always a matter of striking a balance between public roles and government actions and religious authorities and churches. And that balance has shifted pretty dramatically in the last 3 days, like 3 or 4 days.
Let's go back to our callers now. Pam is with us in Bagley. Pam, hello.
Hi, I am interested in both of the cases and wondering what happens. It seems like it's a slippery slope. Wonder what happens when we have a teacher or a coach who's identifying as a Satanist and wants to bring that religion into the football field or into the classroom. And can we support dollars going to a Satanist?
Pam, thanks for the call. And go ahead, Howard. Yeah.
Sorry. The short answer is yes, we will have to. It is not permissible to have a principle like this and apply it only to some religion. In fact, there's already been an instance, I cannot recall where, but of Satanists organizing to hold events on football fields in response to this, not the Supreme Court case, but after this controversy arose. Absolutely, we will have to allow Satanists or any other religion that one can name or make up to partake of the same freedom. And this has always been the problem. It's really important, though, I think, to remember that the reason for the Establishment Clause and the separation of church and state and all this rhetoric, all this way of thinking about the idea that we ought to keep religion out of politics has to do with the fear of majoritarian tyranny. Again, going all the way back to James Madison, the concern was that the majority religion would use its ability to become influential over public affairs to impose its agenda and to oppress or suppress members of minority religions. And so, you know, the danger of Satanists holding prayers on a football field is that it might be shocking or perhaps offensive. The argument is, or the argument was until this week, that the danger of having Christian prayers on a football field is different. It has the capacity to make everyone feel that if they're not Christian, they're not part of the mainstream society and not fully members of the community. That's not really a risk with prayers being conducted by Satanists. But that whole concern about majoritarian domination that was at the heart of the creation of the Establishment Clause at the founding has essentially been written out of that clause by the Roberts Court.
Thanks for that call, Pam. We'll go to Jimmy in Valley Junction now. Jimmy, hi.
Hello, gentlemen. Yeah, I was a little confused when I read the main decision. Well, when I heard about it, it seemed like the money was going right to the school. But when I read the decision, it looks like it goes to the parents, and then the parents made the decision to send the kid to parochial school. And I don't know if there's other options for the parents or if that was the only school they had.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Does it matter if it's a voucher type thing like that, Howard, where state money goes to a parent and then they make the decision on a religious school?
The answer is it does. And that's not new. That goes back to the early 2000s. The term is intervening private choice. So the idea is maybe we're concerned about the state giving money directly to religious schools, but that concern is obviated if the money goes to parents, then parents make a private choice about what schools to attend. The criticisms of that theory are that very often the only religious schools that are eligible for the funds are Christian schools and usually Catholic schools because of support for those schools from the Catholic establishment, which is there is no equivalent establishment for Muslim or Protestant or Jewish or Hindu schools to fund their existence. The other question is, and I think the caller nailed it really when he said, what if there's no other alternative? And that's exactly right. That is, if a religious school opens in an area where, and remember, this was a program directed at rural education, in a rural area where the nearest alternative is far, so that it's at least much easier to go to the religious school, then you have a draw, a reason that would encourage parents who might not even share that necessarily that faith to send their students to that school. The problem with all of these arguments, such as the intervening private choice, there are two problems, excuse me. One is it's a formalistic argument. It's like the old joke, if the missiles go up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, as a line from a song once said. If we know where the money is going, the fact that we funnel it through parents, does that obviate the concerns that led to the creation of the Establishment Clause in the first place? And the second problem is that if there is a lack of other alternatives, then this becomes effectively something that looks a little bit coercive. And for both of those reasons, traditionally, prior to very recent times, these laws would have been upheld.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at separation of church and state after two Supreme Court rulings related to religious issues and public schools around the country. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a climate psychologist tells us how we can find optimism amid negative climate and environmental news. Now, clinics have stopped providing abortions in Wisconsin after the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling last week that overturned Roe v. Wade. That's because of an 1849 law that theoretically went back into effect after that ruling. That law makes exceptions to save a mother's life, not for rape or for incest. Now the State Department of Justice is filing a lawsuit challenging the enforceability of that law. Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call announced that lawsuit this afternoon. The Attorney General joins us now to talk about the suit. Attorney General Call, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
You're suing to block this 170-year-old abortion ban with an eye on a 1985 law. Can you explain what you're focusing on in this suit?
Sure. So first, since Friday, we've begun to see the impacts already from the decision in Dobbs that overruled Roe versus Wade. Safe and legal abortions have stopped in Wisconsin. Our office has begun getting questions from sexual assault nurse examiners who provide forensic examinations to survivors of sexual assault about what the state of the law is. And women in Wisconsin, if this law is enforced, are going to be less free, less equal, and less safe. So today we announced a lawsuit arguing that the 19th century abortion ban is not in effect in Wisconsin, and that first, it's inconsistent with laws that were passed more recently that regulate abortion but don't prohibit it. And when there are inconsistent laws, there's a lot of court precedent for the idea that the more recently passed laws control. And then we've also argued that the disuse of the abortion ban, which has been understood to be unconstitutional for more than 50 years and was only sporadically used even before then, renders it unenforceable as well.
Now, often when lawmakers rewrite laws, if they do a law in 1985 and there's an existing law in the books, they will specifically cross those old laws out. But that, as I understand it, didn't happen here. Does that put you on shakier ground in trying to challenge that 1849 ban?
You know, there's actually a specific sort of doctrine for these types of cases known as the implied repeal doctrine. Believe it or not, the legislature's this is not the only time there's been legislation that's in conflict with other legislation on the books. And courts look to certain issues in deciding whether the old statute was repealed. But here, for example, the old ban provides no exception to save the health of the mother, to protect the health of the mother. But newer laws do contain an exception to for abortions that protect the health. It can't be the case that it is both legal and illegal to perform an abortion to protect the health of the mother. And so it's one example of how these statutes are in conflict. And particularly with criminal laws, which this ban is, you know, deferring to the more permissive law is usually the way that it works. You also usually defer to the more recent law. So our argument is the old ban is no longer enforceable.
Now, that more recent ban was passed some years after Roe v. Wade. Could it be argued that, hey, this was conditional? We have the state law. We can't enforce that state law because Roe v. Wade. So here's some empowering legislation giving the federal reality. Well, now that's gone. So that law is no longer relevant.
You know, in a lot of states, there was legislation passed that was known as trigger law legislation that provided that if Roe was overturned, an immediate ban would come into effect. And we're seeing that play out in a number of states right now. But Wisconsin doesn't have a law like that, and we're in a very different position from those states. And so if the legislature wanted to include a provision saying that the old ban comes back into effect, it could have done that. But it didn't do that here. And, you know, there has been a lot of talk about the Supreme Court's decision returning this issue to the states. But what's happening here by those who are arguing for enforcement of the old ban isn't returning this issue to the states. There's no debate going on at the state capitol about this issue. What they're really trying to do is return us to the 19th century by imposing this old law that, you know, was never voted on by anybody in who's currently living in Wisconsin. And if the legislature wants to act, it can do so. But using this old ban, we think is inappropriate.
Talking to Attorney General Josh Call about his legal challenge to an 1849 law regulating abortions, very much limiting abortions in Wisconsin. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said in a statement today, quote, "Once again, we will do Attorney General Call's job and vigorously defend the law. It's sad that Evers and Call want to break the law instead of work with the legislature," end quote. What's your response to the Assembly Speaker's response?
Well, the whole point of this suit is that it's unclear what the law is. The legislature has passed contradictory laws, and we need the courts to clarify what the law is. Now, you know, just a week ago today, the legislature met for a special session that the governor had called so that we could be prepared for the possibility that the Supreme Court would overrule Roe. Governor Evers was right to call that so we could have some clarity in the law, but rather than address the concerns that we knew were coming, the legislature gabbled in and gabbled out. They for the most part, didn't even show up to address the issue. We need the legislature to act now, because while this litigation is playing out, access to safe and legal abortion in Wisconsin has stopped, and that's impacting people in Wisconsin every day. So the quicker the legislature acts to protect reproductive freedom, the quicker that full equality and freedom and safety for pregnant women in Wisconsin will be restored.
Supposing this ultimately goes to the state Supreme Court and they rule against you and say, in fact, the 1849 law is in effect, what would your approach be then to enforcement?
Well, I've been clear that as long as I'm Attorney General, we're not going to use any resources at the Wisconsin Department of Justice to investigate or prosecute anybody for violations of that old ban. And enforcing that ban would harm the health of women in Wisconsin, and it would do nothing to make our communities safer. We would have to divert resources from the serious kinds of crimes we investigate and prosecute, like homicides and sexual assaults and drug trafficking, to abortion cases. And that doesn't serve the interests of Wisconsinites, and we're not going to do it.
As we wrap things up, what is the timeline now for movement on this suit you announced today?
It's always difficult to predict how long a case will take in court, but this is a case that's focused on legal arguments, and there's not likely to be much dispute about the basic underlying facts here. And so that usually helps cases move faster. I would expect that we will hear from the circuit court in a matter of months, probably. It's not going to be immediate by any means, but I don't think it will stretch on for years either. Of course, there are likely to be appeals after that. But How long that process goes is difficult to say.
Attorney General Call, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Call is the Democratic State Attorney General. He talked to us about a lawsuit he announced with Governor Evers this afternoon seeking to block Wisconsin's 1849 abortion ban, which had been superseded by the Roe v. Wade decision. He cited a 1985 law that contradicts that 1849 ban. Roe v. Wade was overruled last Friday by the U.S. Supreme Court. Coming up, we're feeling the impacts of climate change, but a guest says there's still time to change things, and the key science might be psychology. We'll hear the case for spreading climate hope. That's up next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It can be easy to be overwhelmed by news about climate change. Just last month, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said our planet has the most carbon dioxide has ever had since humans walked the Earth. The U.S. wildfire season continues to grow longer and harsher, and other extreme weather events are getting more common. Again, it can be overwhelming to take in, but our next guest says we don't have to give in to despair or to apathy, and one of the most important climate sciences might just be psychology. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you sometimes feel overwhelmed by environmental and climate change news? What do you do to get over that, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Renee Lertzman is a climate psychologist and founder of Project Inside Out. She's author of the book Environmental Melancholia, Psychoanalytic Dimensions of Engagement that draws in part from research she did in Green Bay. Renee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, I'm very glad to be here with you.
A common response, I think, to climate change, and you've talked about this in TED Talks and elsewhere, can be despair, apathy, denial. What approaches from psychology do you see that can help us work through some of those and take positive action?
Right. Yeah. Well, you named it in your introduction. It's very easy to feel overwhelmed, and it's easy to feel a whole variety of experiences and responses. What I've found over the years is there's actually so much that we can learn and draw from in psychology. So this intersection of kind of where psychology meets climate crisis and environmental issues is just starting to really kind of come together for a lot of people as the anxiety and the kind of the feelings come up more and more. And what I have found to be actually incredibly empowering is recognizing a few things that we now know from psychology. And one of them is that it starts with really honoring and appreciating whatever your experience is. So we want to just start with that baseline of if I'm feeling overwhelmed or if I'm feeling angry, or I'm feeling inspired, or I'm feeling motivated, whatever that is, that in itself makes sense. You know, you make sense, it makes sense. These are really big issues. These are complex, they're systemic, and they are going to bring up different feelings for different people in different circumstances and contexts. And so what we know from the psychological research world is that when we turn towards our experience from that place of, yeah, you know, this is what's happening for me, I'm feeling this way, with real acceptance and real understanding, then it's kind of amazing, because then we're actually able to move through it and navigate it much more easily than, say, telling ourselves, oh, what's wrong with me? I shouldn't be feeling this way. I'm weak. I'm a downer. I'm negative. I'm this, I'm that. And we can fall into that sort of self-talk, which actually is not helpful. And it takes us down a path where paradoxically we become almost more mired in that place of sort of a, it's a bit of a spiral.
How do we break out of that kind of self-talk?
Well, we start with being able to acknowledge it, like practicing the ability to notice and pay attention to what it is that we're feeling. And that practice of what Tara Brach, for example, the writer and Buddhist, talks about, radical acceptance, you know, like really coming from that place of turning towards oneself, maybe taking a few moments, you know, doing what you need to do to kind of remind yourself, like, okay, you know, this is what's up for me. But what's also really important is to recognize this isn't an individual problem, that, you know, I work around the world. I work with groups and organizations, you know, all around the globe. And I can tell you that many, many, many people are experiencing very similar things. And we may not be talking about it. We may not be open about it. I found that it's actually a very radical, powerful act to begin to have these conversations with each other and to really just start sharing, you know, this is what's happening for me, or this is what I'm worried about, or what I'm concerned about. What is your experience? And then it helps us really move through that spiral.
That's how to break out of self-talk. Another thing you think a lot about is a situation where person A feels really strongly, is really worried about climate change, and is wondering why everyone around them seems to be so listless and apathetic and uncaring about it. Well, the way I framed it just now, you say, may not be the best way to frame it.
Well, so first, it's very normal and natural to feel that way. So right off the bat, you know, I don't know anyone who, you know, who's paying attention and sensitive and tracking what's happening doesn't have some aspect of that experience of waking up and looking around and basically saying, what the hell, you know, what the heck, like, what is wrong with you? Wake up. We got to do something now. So that's a very normal and natural response to have. But we need to be able to move past that place, because that's actually really counterproductive in terms of our, if we want to actually be effective. And so, so a couple of things. One is, you know, the body of work that I've been working, you know, developing over a couple of decades, it actually started when I was doing my field work in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So it's meaningful for me to be on this show and to be talking with folks in Wisconsin. And what I was doing was spending time in Green Bay, having conversations with all kinds of people about the environment, about climate, and about the water, about the Great Lakes, and about the Fox River and the Green Bay. And what I found in having these conversations and really listening to people closely is that I couldn't really, I didn't meet a single person who literally didn't care, right? So what I found is that what's happening more often is that people are going through a lot of very complicated responses to what is happening, and have ways of coping with that and have ways of dealing with that. And that may look like not caring. It may look like what we would call apathy or tuning out or even outright hostility. That actually these are really big issues that for a lot of people are really hard to process. And so this idea of the myth of apathy kind of took hold when I was spending time in Green Bay, which has really carried through a lot of what I've been doing over the past several years. And going back to your prompt about that tendency to want to kind of turn towards people and shake them and just feel really frustrated, and that's not always productive. The way I talk about that now is that we have a tendency to feel like we have to either educate, give people more information, or we feel like we have to be cheerleaders and try to be really positive and upbeat, or we might feel like we have to be writing, R-I-G-H-T, which is the moralizing, preaching, like, this is why this is the right thing to do, and sort of, you know, come at people that way, when in actuality, going back to psychology, and especially the field of motivational interviewing in the public health sector, is that we are generally more open and responsive when we're feeling listened to and when we feel that there's partnership and guiding. And so I spend a lot of my time talking about guiding. What does it mean to be a guide, you know, who cares deeply about what's happening with the climate, with the planet, and being more thoughtful about the tendency to write, educate, or cheerlead, which is what you were describing there. And it's actually really hard to do. It's a practice. It takes time. But the first step is actually the self-awareness to be able to reflect and consider, oh, okay, well, what is my tendency and how are people experiencing me? And then the other part of that is how do I manage my own emotional reaction so that I can show up in a way that's, you know, maybe more of a guide and less of a educator, cheerleader, or writer.
Talking to Renee Lertzman, a climate psychologist, founder of Project Inside Out, talking about how to talk about complicated issues like climate change. Renee, can you talk some more about how to open that kind of conversation? It's not me and you arguing or yelling at each other or one-upping one another with our virtue. How do we have that kind of honest and, I guess, empathetic conversation?
Exactly. So I take my cue from what I've learned, especially in motivational interviewing, which is the practice of coming at these conversations from a place of inquiry, of compassion, and a seeking to understand, which is actually really hard when the stakes are high and we're maybe triggered or we have very strong feelings. It's very hard to do that, but it's absolutely possible to do that, especially with, again, self-awareness and practice. But when I'm approaching interactions, conversations with people who might be in very different places around this, I start with asking first, what is your experience? Like, what are you noticing? What are you thinking about? Where are you at with this? Right. So I don't lead with, you know, this is what I care about. What do you think? Do you agree with me or not? I start with, hey, I'm really curious. Like, where are you at with this? What's your experience been? And so that's number one, is coming from that place of curiosity, seeking to understand what people may already know and not know. And then the next part of that is reflecting back what you hear being said. So reflective listening, to basically say, so you this, that, you know, reflecting without correcting, educating, you know, kind of trying to change the person, you're just reflecting back. And it's amazing, if you take just a few minutes of doing this, it really helps establish some trust and just a sense of, you know, people can kind of relax a little bit more. It's like, okay, this is safe. I'm not going to be attacked. I'm not going to be shamed. This person is going to tell me what's wrong with me. You know, it's really okay for me to be where I am with this. So that's the second part. The third really important part is to ask for some kind of permission before offering your perspective or more information. So for example, I would say, you know, I would ask some open-ended questions. What's your experience? What have you noticed? Where are you at with this? What troubles you? What doesn't? And then I would reflect back what I heard. And then I would basically say, would you be open to hearing where I'm at with this? Or would you be open, or is it okay if I tell you some things I've learned recently that have really gotten my attention? It's just a way of kind of asking permission. And that's another thing that's really key in motivational interviewing, is ask for permission before you offer. And so then the person can either say yes or no. And usually people will say yes, because we see ourselves as generally open people, open-minded. And so that in itself is really powerful, because I'm hearing myself basically say, yes, I'm open, even if I might be feeling kind of mixed about it. And then it gives, you know, me, a climate concerned person, that ability to go into this territory and then to check in and say, so where are you at? How is this landing with what I'm saying? So it's an actual conversation. You're not trying to pitch, persuade, motivate, change anyone. You're really seeking to have a conversation. And paradoxically, that is what shifts people most, is having a really good, substantial, respectful conversation.
And we'll leave it there. Renee, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Renee Lertzman, climate psychologist, founder of Project Inside Out, also author of Environmental Melancholia, inspired in part, as you heard, by her work in Green Bay. Tomorrow on Central Time, more on recent Supreme Court rulings, this time guns. That's tomorrow on Central Time.